Hello, you're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 5, Lights, Camera, Action. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. The last four episodes have seen a lot of the ground laid in preparation for the Russian Revolution, underpinnings to historical background. But today, we finally start our journey. This episode is all about everything that happened at the end of February 1917, which saw the nearly overnight collapse of the Tsarist regime in the Russian Empire, and set in motion a chain of events that would lead to the first successful workers' revolution in world history. I am as eager to get to the action as I hope the rest of you are, so strap in. But first, we need a quick update on where all of our major players are before the action starts in earnest. Tsar Nikolai II, in the lead-up to the February Revolution, is in Tsarskoye Selo, which translates to the Tsar's Village, the royal estate outside the city limits. But on the night of the 22nd of February, he leaves for Mogilyov, a small city in present-day Belarus, which was serving at the time as army headquarters. I am sure absolutely nothing of importance will happen in the Tsar's absence. The State Duma, the national legislative body of the Russian Empire that was created by the October Manifesto at the conclusion of the Revolution of 1905, has the first session of its fourth iteration on the 14th of February. Secretly, however, the Tsar had already signed an order on the 8th, dissolving the Duma before it even had a chance to meet. Crucially, though, he had not dated the order, and had not announced it publicly. Basically, he had signed a blank check, indicating his readiness to dissolve the Duma at the slightest excuse to do so. Luckily for these deputies, their term is sure to be a quiet and calm one, and the Tsar's secret order won't matter at all. Many of our revolutionary leaders are not actually in the capital in February. To avoid arrest, Lenin had left the Russian Empire in 1907, as the Tsarist regime had cracked down on revolutionary parties. In the intervening years, he had bounced around Europe, and in February 1917, he is living in Zurich, researching a book with which we are already familiar, State and Revolution. His comrade, Zinoviev, is with him. Kamenev and Stalin are both separately in exile in Siberia. Trotsky had recently arrived in New York City, and in the month preceding the revolution, was writing articles and making speeches to other émigrés. Back in the capital, plenty of other local Bolshevik leaders have been enduring harassment by the police for a while now, and are either in hiding or in prison, although it is important to know that there is a functioning Bolshevik party in the capital at this time, and we will catch up with them in a bit. As for the Mensheviks and SRs, their leaders, and I'll mention their names as they come up, are similarly either in exile abroad, in exile within the empire, or in prison. So on net, they are scattered and disorganized, but don't worry, at least they have plenty of time to prepare for an upheaval in the unlikely event that one should occur. The Russian bureaucracy is in shambles. Nikolai had made it a habit throughout the war to dismiss and shuffle his ministers practically on a whim, making it impossible to maintain any sort of consistency or cohesion in the government. Not that that's at all important when fighting an all-out war. On the 27th of December, 1916, Nikolai dismissed his prime minister, Alexander Trepov, and named Nikolai Galitsyn as Trepov's successor. But Galitsyn was so hesitant to take the position that he begged the Tsar to name someone else before reluctantly accepting the appointment. Fortunately for Galitsyn, his term will be uneventful. The last thing he wants is to be in the hot seat if anything happens. The capital itself is in a bad way. First of all, there was a name change after the start of the war. St. Petersburg sounded too German, so the name was changed to the much more Slavic Freedom Fries. I meant Petrograd. But the denizens of Petrograd are in dire straits. Inflation is out of control, workers' wages are not anything approaching adequate, food and fuel shortages are everywhere, the winter of 1916-1917 in Petrograd is a brutal one, And as we know, the war continues to go badly and is deeply, deeply unpopular. A few regiments are stationed in Petrograd to maintain order under the iron command of one General Sergei Khabalov. Too bad for the workers, there's absolutely no hope of their situation improving anytime soon. As we move through the events of the revolution, we will first follow the streets, that is, the workers, as they finally take matters into their own hands. After that, we will see how the Tsar, the Duma, the socialist parties, and then the rest of the country react. Because that's really all anyone else will be able to do, react, as events unfold at a breakneck pace. Finally, as the dust from the political earthquake settles, we'll take stock of the new arrangement of power and what it holds for the future. One final quick note about dates. I mentioned in the episode on Leninism that the Russian Empire at this time operated on the Julian calendar, which lagged 13 days behind the Gregorian calendar used by the rest of Europe and North America. All dates I've given for events that have happened in Russia the last few episodes have been in the so-called old style. Up to now, this distinction has not mattered. However, for what's about to happen, the 13-day difference actually carries the events from February on the Julian calendar to March on the Gregorian. In Russia, it's called the February Revolution because that's how they marked the days at the time. But if you look up these events yourself, you're likely to see the dates given in March. Obviously, I'm sticking with convention here and will continue using old-style dates for events in Russia until the Bolsheviks switch the country to the Gregorian calendar in almost exactly a year from now. But I don't want anyone out there to be confused if they come across new style dates out in the wild, so there you go. Okay, with all of that out of the way, no more dilly-dallying. We've got our cast of characters, we've got the stage fully set, nothing left but lights, camera, action. The traditional date for the start of the February Revolution is the 23rd. This was International Women's Day, and women textile workers went on strike en masse when they got wind of upcoming bread rationing by the authorities. But it was not the first strike Petrograd saw that year, or even that month. Strikes had become exceedingly common as the war dragged on. For example, there was a strike on the 9th of January, commemorating Bloody Sunday in 1905. On the 18th of February, there was another strike at the Putilov Iron Works, one of the biggest industrial factories in the entire empire, when a demand for wage increase was denied. The strike morphed into a lockout by the owner and the indefinite closure of the plant on the 22nd, which pushed a large contingent of workers out into the streets. So, when the women joined the strike on the 23rd, labor unrest reached a critical mass. Trotsky reports in his History of the Russian Revolution that around 90,000 workers struck that day. The women, however, were the first workers to carry explicitly political signs, demanding, quote, down with the Tsar, or down with the autocracy, and down with the war. It is for these two reasons that we mark the 23rd as the first of the 5 days that constituted the February Revolution. Often called riots both then and now by those who either intentionally or inadvertently wish to strip the February Revolution of its class character, the strikes had very clearly stated goals, like almost every strike everywhere in history. In this instance, the demands included an 8-hour workday, a pay raise, an end to inflation, and a rejection of food rationing, to name a few. But, as we just saw, this strike carried with it a political dimension, as strikers started to call for radical political change as well. Of course, the strikes continued the next day, with more and more workers joining in. This second day of strikes was the first day that saw violence between the workers and the Tsarist authorities. Police and soldiers were sent to quell the uprising, and were met with rocks and ice shards. Although there was no shooting that day, the armed wing of the Tsarist state did use physical violence against the workers, mostly through beating them with bludgeons. The 24th was also significant in that it saw the resurrection of an old vehicle of workers' authority. Elections were held for the new Petrograd Soviet of Workers' Deputies. On the 25th, according to Trotsky, who cites some of the last czarist records ever made, 240,000 workers struck that day, which, if true, would be just over half of the total population of workers in the city. As Petrograd ground even more to a halt, police and soldiers continued to fight with striking workers, and this time, shots were fired. In response, workers threw rocks, bottles, even hand grenades. But there were already signs that soldiers in Petrograd were becoming unreliable for the Tsarist regime. Soldiers were pulled primarily from the peasantry, and they recognized that the workers were striking essentially for their lives, for the means to feed themselves and their families, the means to keep from freezing in the winter. The workers spoke directly to them, pleading for their support and explaining their reasonable demands. Trotsky reports that throughout the city, in order to avoid provoking the rank and file of the army into taking action against them, the workers began focusing their attacks on the police, and the soldiers began to let them. On the evening of the 25th, the Tsar sent a telegram to Khabarov, ordering the total suppression of the workers, citing the threat to the nation the movement represented while the war was ongoing. Authorities started arresting leaders of the movement, including Bolsheviks. But by nightfall that day, the Vyborg district, the workers' district located in the northwest sector of the city, had actually chased out the police and was under worker control. The 26th was a Sunday, and Tony Cliff, in his book All Power to the Soviets, writes that it was relatively quiet. The factories had been closed as they had served as the gathering points for strikes and demonstrations. In fact, it was so quiet that a Bolshevik organizer named Kayurov wondered if the revolution hadn't petered out. But by the nightfall of the 26th, the soldiers began talking back in their barracks. They did not like having to fire on people who were only, quote, rioting over completely unacceptable living conditions. People who had been talking to them for days on the streets, pleading and explaining themselves, and frankly, who had been making perfect sense. What's more, these workers, these people, had shown immense restraint when dealing with the soldiers. As long as they did not mess with the workers did not mess with them. Such conversations occurred in regiments throughout the night until the morning of the 27th, and it was on this day that the Tsar truly lost his capital and his crown. On that fateful morning, the Volynsky Regiment was the first to mutiny. They refused orders to leave their barracks to engage the workers. Soon after, many other regiments, including the Preobrazhensky, Litovsky, Pavlovsky, Semyonovsky, and Moskovsky regiments, also defected to the workers. The Preobrazhensky was the first regiment to disarm the police who were still fighting against their new allies. Army officers tried in vain to control their soldiers, ordering them to stand down, return to barracks, and await further instruction. But they were completely ignored. A relative handful of officers who had become hated for their cruelty toward the soldiers under their command were targeted, beaten, and killed. But for the most part, realizing that they could either be swept away by the flood or get to higher ground, but that there was no more holding back the waters, the officers of the capital's garrison simply abandoned their posts. In the end, as many as a combined total of 450,000 workers and soldiers are estimated to have been on strike and in revolt against their military commanders on the 27th. Street fighting between police and workers went on throughout the day, although it was clear by then which side was going to win. Workers raided the prisons around Petrograd to free political prisoners, and seized rifles and ammunition from the Peter and Paul Fortress, a giant military fortress situated on an island in the middle of the Neva River, directly across from the Winter Palace. Workers and soldiers converged on the Tavrichesky Dvorets, the Torrid Palace, and turned it into what Trotsky called the headquarters of the revolution. Throughout the day on the 27th, the soldiers held elections to their own Soviet of Soldiers' Deputies. The end of the day saw the unification of the two Soviets into the officially named Unified Petrograd Soviet of Workers and Soldiers' Deputies, with an executive committee made up of Mensheviks, Bolsheviks, and SRs. By nightfall, Petrograd was more or less in the hands of the workers and soldiers. Tsarist officials had either been arrested, although some were released after questioning, or had fled the city or gone into hiding. Khabalov, the general who had overseen the complete mutiny of the army in Petrograd, was now a guest of the Petrograd Soviet, with free room and board provided to him in the Trubetskoy prison of the Peter and Paul fortress. How did the Tsar react to the news that his capital was in revolt? In a perfect summary of the complete chaos of his regime in the final years, he had gotten conflicting reports. The army and police were wiring to him that the situation was dire and the capital was in danger of slipping out of the regime's control completely. Remember, he did wire back to Khabalov to suppress the workers. On the other hand, his wife Alexandra was sending him letters saying the ministers were overreacting and that everything was actually fine, which I am sure she could witness herself from her palatial estate at Tsarskoye Selo, which was, again, outside the city. Inexplicably not sure whom to believe, Nikolai did not actually leave Mogilyov for Petrograd until the 28th, but by then it was too late, and he would never make it. There was nothing sinister going on, mind you. It was just that the workers now controlled the railways and simply would not let him pass. As a result, his train was rerouted to Pskov, roughly halfway between Mogilyov and the capital, near the present-day border with Estonia. Once there, the Tsar met with his army chief and a few Duma deputies, and the situation was explained in as stark terms as possible. The capital was lost. The workers were in control, and the soldiers stationed there were in mutiny and in solidarity with the workers. There were no more soldiers immediately available to take the city back, and even if there had been, army morale was so low due to the ongoing war that sending them in was too risky. They might defect and join their mutinous comrades. And now came the kicker. The Tsar was told that the only path left to him was abdication. At first, Nikolai resisted, but eventually he agreed on the 2nd of March. At first, he wanted to abdicate in favor of his son, Alexei. But when he realized he would be forced into exile and Alexei, who again was only 12 at the time, and in constant danger from his hemophilia, would be left alone, he instead tried to abdicate in favor of his brother, the Grand Prince Mikhail. Mikhail, however, likely knew it would be crazy and possibly suicidal to take the throne now, and so he deferred in favor of a constituent assembly of the peoples of the Russian Empire. If they wanted him, if they elected him Tsar as they had his ancestor 304 years ago, he would take the throne, but he would not force himself upon them. Thus ended the great Romanov dynasty. Technically, legally, the monarchy was only suspended until the Constituent Assembly, but since, spoiler alert, that was never called, this de facto marks the end of Tsarism in Russia. Nikolai and his family were now private citizens. They were placed under house arrest at Tsarskoye Selo until they were moved to the interior of the country as the German army advanced on Petrograd, because remember World War I is still going on? We will eventually check back in with them in the summer of 1918 for what I am sure the majority of you already know is their rather ignoble end. But other than that little coda, the Tsar has now exited the show, stage right. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. If the Tsar personally was outside the immediate blast zone of the revolution when it occurred, the rest of his government was not so lucky. It's time to check back in with the Duma, which had been in session for 10 days before everything started popping off. Once it did, though, they scrambled to figure out what to do next. On the 26th, Prime Minister Galitsyn dated that order Nikolai had signed about the dissolution of the Duma. On the 27th, the decree was made public, and the deputies dutifully obeyed the order. Kind of. Certain members of the Duma gathered in the Tauride Palace, the same Tauride Palace the Soviet was at that very moment being founded, and declared themselves the Provisional Committee of the government. Now, there is one thing I have not mentioned about the Duma so far, and that is the attitudes of the various socialist parties toward this official organ of state power. Since this was the fourth Duma, we do not need to concern ourselves with the attitudes toward the previous three iterations, but we do need to note that this Duma did include delegations from the Mensheviks and SRs, as they had decided to participate in those elections. The Bolsheviks, however, had decided on a boycott, and so had no members in either the Duma or the Provisional Committee. As events of the revolution unfolded in the streets of Petrograd, the committee began to discuss what, if anything, they should do while the workers and soldiers were seizing control of the city. The group included many bourgeois and conservative members, such as the conservative landlord Mikhail Rodzianka, the factory owner, landowner, and financier Mikhail Tereshenko, Prince Georgi Lvov, a cadet and member of the nobility, Pavel Milyukov, another cadet, hereditary noble, and member of the intelligentsia, and the known arch-conservative royalist, Alexander Guchkov. But, as I just said, there were also a few who identified as socialists, Mensheviks and SRs, including Alexander Kerensky, whom we've already met, and Nikolai Chechidze, a Georgian Menshevik. On the 2nd of March, the same day the Tsar abdicated, the Provisional Committee announced they were forming the Provisional Government, and declared as one of its chief goals and purposes the organization of the Constituent Assembly, the same Constituent Assembly to which the Grand Prince Mikhail Romanov had deferred when refusing the crown. The assembly was meant to be a grand coming together of the entire Russian peoples to form a new democratic government, where the different factions, parties, and groups would hash out exactly what a post-Tsar Russia would look like. But, well, we'll get there eventually. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Wait, a Soviet and a provisional government? Two power centers? How's that supposed to work? And we will talk all about this dual power soon enough. But first, we have to see how the socialist parties themselves, and the Bolsheviks in particular, were reacting to the 5 days and the revolution, and then also how the rest of the country took the news. The February Revolution came as a complete bolt out of the blue for all the socialist parties of Russia. Trotsky writes in his History of the Russian Revolution, quote, "On the eve, it occurred to no one that International Women's Day could become the first day of the revolution," end quote. Nobody, not the factory owners, not the police, not the landowners, neither the cadets, nor the Mensheviks, nor the SRs, not even the Bolsheviks, was prepared or had in any way planned or triggered the revolution. It had, in fact, erupted quite spontaneously. I mentioned in the beginning that, despite the fact that the intellectual leadership of the Bolshevik Party was in exile for most of the war, and despite near-constant harassment at the hands of the police, there was a Bolshevik organization inside Russia and in Petrograd. When the strikes that eventually evolved into the revolution started, yet more known Bolsheviks were arrested. Still, despite all this, there was a three-man central committee for the Petrograd Bolsheviks, made up of Alexander Gavrilovich Shlyapnikov, Pyotr Antonovich Zalutsky, and Vyacheslav Mikhailovich Molotov. Yes, that Molotov. But they were running a pretty bare-bones operation and lacked the resources to instigate a revolution. In fact, the Petrograd Bolsheviks had even been arguing against strikes, and Zalutsky refused to help the workers obtain arms, thinking there was no way they could succeed at an armed insurrection. But when the masses took matters into their own hands, the Bolsheviks, as well as the Mensheviks and the SRs, quickly realized the train was leaving the station, So they hopped on and started agitation campaigns among the workers in an effort to lead the movement. On the 25th, the Bolsheviks came out with a call for a general strike, but only after 200,000 workers had been on a de facto general strike for days. It was really only with the formation of the Petrograd Soviet that the parties assumed any sort of official leading role in the revolution as members of the executive committee. In most histories of the Russian Revolution, the focus is on Petrograd, and for good reason. As the capital, it was where all the important institutions of government and administration were concentrated. It was the most populous and economically advanced city, and had been the capital of Russia since its founding in 1703. Generally speaking, as much as possible throughout the run of this show, I want to shed light on what was happening in the rest of the country. The Soviet Union was so much more than just Moscow dictating orders to the rest of the country. I am, however, limited in my resources to mostly books and articles of research already done, since I don't have access to any historical archives. Fortunately, on today's subject of the February Revolution, Trotsky does recount some of what happened in other cities across the empire as news of what took place in Petrograd rolled in. So I'm going to let him speak in his own words and present to you now select passages from The History of the Russian Revolution, Volume 1, as a general summary of events across the empire. Quote, "The revolution in Moscow was only an echo of the insurrection in Petrograd. The same attitudes among the workers and soldiers, but expressed less clearly. Only on the 27th of February, at the factories and plants of Moscow, did strikes begin, and then demonstrations. By 2 o'clock, many soldiers from various regiments appeared at the building of the city Duma, searching for a way to join the revolution. The prisons were opened. In the city, there were individual shots fired, but in general, there were neither armed clashes nor casualties. Petrograd held the answer for Moscow." End quote. He continues later about the other cities in the empire. Quote, "In a series of provincial cities, the movement began only on the 1st of March, even after the revolution had already occurred in Moscow. In Tver, workers left their jobs for the barracks in a demonstration and, mingling with the soldiers, walked the streets of the city. In Nizhny Novgorod, thousands gathered at the city Duma, which in the majority of cities played the role of the Tauride Palace. After the mayor's speech, workers moved with red banners to free political prisoners from the prisons. In Samara and Saratov, meetings took place. Soviets of workers' deputies were organized. In regards to a series of other provincial cities, Pskov, Oryol, Rybinsk, Penza, Kazan, Tsaritsyn, note, which is present-day Volgograd, quote, "The record notes on the 2nd of March. News came of the takeover that had occurred, and the population joined the revolution. Reports of the revolution flowed into the villages from the nearest cities, sometimes from the authorities, but mainly through bazaars, workers, and soldiers on leave. The village accepted the revolution more slowly and less enthusiastically than the city, but not less deeply. It," he means the village, "connected it," he means the revolution, "with the war and with the land." It is not an exaggeration to say that Petrograd accomplished the February Revolution. The rest of the country joined it. Nowhere except in Petrograd was there a struggle. In the whole country, there was not found any groups of the population, parties, institutions, or military units which chose to come out in defense of the old regime. Neither in the rear nor at the front was there found a brigade or a regiment which was prepared to fight for Nikolai II. End quote. Nearly 25 years of mistakes and missteps by the Tsar. The Khadinka tragedy, the botched war with Japan, Bloody Sunday, the mishandling of the revolution of 1905, and the subsequent walking back of whatever gains had been made that year. The following decade of repression. The utter incompetence, both military and administrative, in running the war with Germany, the embarrassment of Rasputin, all of it had brought his regime to the point where absolutely nobody across his entire vast empire was inspired to stand up for him. As regards the Soviets Trotsky mentions being formed in other cities, Tony Cliff claims that by the 22nd of March, there was not a town or city in Russia that did not have its own Soviet, with nearly 80 of them in direct contact with the Petrograd Soviet. Back in Petrograd, by the 3rd of March, there were two competing centers of power, both residing in different wings of the Tauride Palace, the Provisional Government and the Petrograd Soviet of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies. The Provisional Government had the veneer of officialdom, having been born from the Duma, which had been the last elected governing body of the Tsarist regime. But the Soviet had the overwhelming support of the masses, the workers and the soldiers. A natural question that follows from this correlation of forces is, if the masses were behind it, why didn't the Soviet simply overthrow the Provisional Government? The answer to this lies in the class character of both institutions. The first thing to note about the Provisional Government is that its first slate of ministers were all the aforementioned members of the ruling classes of the nobility and bourgeoisie, Lvov, Tereshchenko, Miliukov, Guchkov. Even Kerensky had previously been a small business proprietor before becoming a socialist. So it was therefore not ideological propaganda, nor was it incorrect, when the Bolsheviks said over and over again that the Provisional Government represented the bourgeoisie. It was literally controlled by landowners, business owners, and bankers. The Soviet, meanwhile, at this early stage, was dominated by Mensheviks and SRs. These parties not only were connected to the Provisional Government by their elected delegates to the Fourth Duma, from which the government was spawned, a connection, remember, the Bolsheviks did not share, which likely helped them avoid any influence by the government. But the Mensheviks and SRs were ideologically aligned with the government as well. First, since the SRs were ostensibly the peasant party, remember that peasants as a class lack truly revolutionary socialist leanings. Their material interests are not in overcoming capitalism, but in taking control of their own plots of land and becoming successful within a capitalist framework. As for the Mensheviks, recall from the episode Cast of Characters that one of the biggest ideological differences between them and the Bolsheviks was that they firmly believed the bourgeoisie should take power after the overthrow of the monarchy. They believed the end of Tsarism in Russia would finally allow the bourgeoisie to take its rightful place in the historical development of the country, and so were loath to take power for themselves. Tsereteli, a Menshevik, spoke of compromise with the bourgeoisie as, quote, the only road for the revolution. The thinking was axiomatic. The bourgeoisie must rule, and so the best thing to do was to strike as beneficial a deal as possible with them on behalf of the workers and peasants. Kind of sounds like that phenomenon of opportunism Lenin warned us all about. But even that's not enough to explain the Soviets' failure to immediately do away with the Provisional Government, because as we just saw, the masses were not exactly inclined to follow rules and do what they were told. The simple truth is, the masses which supported the Soviet to the hilt were not sufficiently revolutionary in February and March of 1917 to take over completely. First of all, the soldiers were actually overrepresented in the Soviet compared to the workers. Of the 150,000 soldiers garrisoned in Petrograd, there was one representative from each company, for a total of 2,000 soldiers as members of the Soviet. This was against the 450,000 workers in the capital, represented by 800 members in the Soviet. Breaking down those workers' numbers even further, the smaller factories were disproportionately represented against the larger factories. The large factories held 87% of the workers in Petrograd at the time and had 484 delegates in the Soviet. A majority, yes, but only 60.5% of the total of the workers' deputies. The other 13% of workers from smaller factories and workshops had the remaining 39.5% of worker representation. This dynamic was also at play in other Soviets across the country. For example, in Moscow, roughly half of the workers in the city were employed at about 20 large factories, and half were employed in a myriad of smaller workshops and mills. But the workers from the large factories were represented by about 60 delegates in the Soviet, while the workers from the smaller workshops had about 100 total delegates. This is important because workers from smaller workplaces tend to be, although are not always, less radical than workers from larger, more concentrated facilities. It's also crucial to remember, as I mentioned earlier, the soldiers were overwhelmingly peasants, not workers, further diluting the radical mindset of the Soviet rank and file. Thus, there really was no appetite in the Soviet, at least at this point, for taking over from the provisional government entirely. So, okay, that's why the Soviets did not immediately do away with the provisional government. But why didn't the government do away with the Soviets? It is because the government, for its part, was terrified of the Soviet. It saw masses of armed workers supported by trained soldiers as a daily reminder of how precarious their own situation was. They desperately wanted to disarm and disband the Soviet, but knew that any move explicitly against the Soviet would provoke a sharp and possibly violent response. And so a state of dvoye vlastya, or dual power, became the norm for the next 8 months. Tony Cliff calls it a marriage of convenience, and I think he's correct. The two camps distrusted and detested each other, but one side lacked the material means, while the other lacked the ideological conviction to rule on its own. We will see just how tenuous this relationship becomes over the course of the year, as the masses see again and again with their own eyes that the provisional government is not, in fact, acting in their interests. What's even more crucial is that the Bolsheviks will be the lone party encouraging the workers and soldiers, and eventually the peasantry en masse, that they actually don't need the bourgeoisie. Like, at all. To close this out for today, I want to offer a rebuttal to a common refrain we hear about the Russian Revolution. Popular histories of this period, even starting in February, are shot through with the accusation that the socialist parties, and particularly the Bolsheviks, as they eventually emerge victorious from the revolution, were trying to hijack a populist movement to take control of the revolution for their own ends. It should come as no surprise that I and communists everywhere reject this characterization entirely, as one based on, at best, a superficial understanding of the events of the revolution, and at worst, and more commonly, a conscious attempt to discredit the Bolsheviks and mask the dynamic interplay of classes from this period, which led to the workers uniting behind the Bolsheviks in an overwhelming majority. First, please recall from the episode on Leninism that the Vanguard Party was conceived as an entity existing not outside of the workers, but among them. Even by February, the socialist parties, and particularly the Bolsheviks, were a force in Petrograd, albeit a small one. Many workers were members of these parties, and even more had heard their speeches and read their leaflets. Socialist agitation among the workers had helped immensely to prepare the workers mentally for the strikes, revolts, and street battles that made up the February Revolution, specifically by raising the level of class consciousness among them to the point where they could unite into such a sudden and overwhelming force to sweep away the defunct Tsarist state. Second, as I pointed out earlier, one of the biggest reasons why the socialist parties did not lead the charge was because most of the leaders of the parties were in Siberia, abroad, or imprisoned. The Tsarist police had been successful in keeping, particularly the Bolsheviks, as the most militant socialist party, disorganized and persecuted. No organization, no party, no group can be at the forefront of events under such conditions. And when those repressive conditions were removed, the socialist parties were able to function more effectively. But, most importantly, in the end, none of the Tsarist repression mattered. The messages of the Bolsheviks and the other parties had already become a part of the workers' movement, which is why Trotsky concludes his chapter, Who Led the February Revolution, with the following. Quote, "To the question posed above of who led the February insurrection, we can consequently answer with enough certainty, the conscious and seasoned workers, developed in the main by Lenin's party. But we must add here, this leadership," note, he means here the general leading role of the workers in the revolution, not any specific party leadership, quote, turned out to be sufficient to secure the victory of the insurrection, but it was not enough to immediately secure for the proletarian vanguard a leading role in the revolution, end quote. As a final callback to the episode on Leninism, remember that Lenin argued that spontaneity in the workers' movement could sometimes be enough to achieve great singular feats, such as what we've witnessed here today. But that without proper leadership and guidance, even the greatest achievements would be insufficient to actually overcome capitalism and bourgeois influences. Believe me when I say that the rest of 1917 will be the best case imaginable for proving just how correct Lenin was. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.